everybody. We're thrilled to have you here. I'm Brian Tramont. I'm the chair of the Telecommunications and Electronic Media Practice Group and the managing partner at Wilkinson Barker Knauer. We're thrilled to have you all here today. Our discussion will feature a conversation on issues like artificial intelligence, cybersecurity, tech platform regulation, spectrum policy, broadband funding, and a host of other things. We have no shortage of topics today and a great panel with many friends, Robin and Scott, Umair and Mario. We're thrilled and appreciate that you guys made the time to join us today to discuss these important topics. For the second year in a row, it is my pleasure to introduce Judge Park, Circuit Judge in the Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit. He was appointed the Court of Appeals in May of 2019. His BA is from Princeton. His JD is from Yale, where he served as the managing editor of the Yale Law Journal. After graduating, he served as a law clerk, to Judge Alito and then ultimately to Justice Alito on the Supreme Court. Then he was an associate at WilmerHale. He served as attorney advisor in the Department of Justice, Office of Legal Counsel. He worked at Dechert, at first as counsel and then as partner. And then finally, he joined Consovoy, McCarthy, and Park as a named partner, where he specialized in appellate and complex civil litigation. And also during that time, he served as an adjunct professor at George Mason Law School. It is my pleasure to introduce Judge Park to begin our conversation. Thank you.
Thanks, Brian, for the introduction, and to the Federalist Society for organizing this panel and for inviting me to moderate. As the title of the program suggests, our topic is a broad one. Administration and review and what lies ahead, communications and technology policy challenges and times of transformational change. As everyone here knows, telecommunications law and policy is hugely important for technological innovation, economic growth, national security, and it has been a busy year for the FCC at full strength for over a year now. So we have a wide range of topics to cover, including spectrum policy, net neutrality, broadband funding, the BEAD program, broadband equity access and deployment, the future of the Universal Service Fund, and regulation of AI, cybersecurity, and big tech, among others. And of course, we'll be talking about the implications of the election and what we might expect to see in the second Trump administration. We have a distinguished panel of experts with decades of experience in the telecommunications area to walk us through these topics, and their bios are available online, but let me briefly introduce them. To my right, Professor Mario Loyola, a research assistant professor and director of Environmental Finance and Risk Management Program in the Institute of Environment and FIU Preeminent Program. He also teaches administrative and environmental law at the College of Law and is a senior research fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Professor Loyola has worked on energy and environment policy and regulatory issues for many years in and out of government. He's a former associate director for regulatory reform at the White House Council on Environmental Quality and also served at the Pentagon and in the U.S. Senate. Scott Blake Harris, I'm going in the order that they'll be presenting their opening statements. Scott Blake Harris is founder and managing partner of Crest Hill Advisors. Scott has been a legal and policy professional in Washington for 48 years, mostly focused on telecommunications, technology, and energy issues. I'm 48 years old. He has a deep experience in both government and the private sector. Before founding Crest Hill Advisors, Scott served as the senior spectrum advisor and director of the National Spectrum Strategy at the NTIA in the Commerce Department. He previously served as general counsel of the Department of Energy, as the first chief of the International Bureau at the FCC, and as chief counsel for export administration at the Department of Commerce. Robin Colwell, principal with BGR's Commerce and Infrastructure Practice. She provides clients with strategic insights and advocacy on complex telecommunications, technology, and cybersecurity issues. Robin's experience includes the private sector and all three branches of government. She served as legislative counsel for Senate Commerce Committee members, chief of staff to FCC Commissioner Michael O'Reilly, and chief counsel to the House Energy and Commerce Committee for Communications and Technology. Robin also served at the White House National Economic Council under President Trump as senior advisor to Director Larry Kudlow, developing administration policy and leading interagency implementation of priorities, including 5G deployment and other initiatives. And lastly, but not least, is Umair Javid, senior vice president and general counsel, CTIA. He joined CTIA in 2023 as Senior Vice President of Spectrum, where he has been responsible for advancing the wireless industry's spectrum priorities, both domestically and internationally. And before that, Amer was Chief Counsel to FCC Chairwoman Jessica Rosenworcel. He served as the FCC designee on President Biden's Competition Council, led the FCC's National Security Policy Council, and represented the agency at international treaty writing conferences. The format of our opening statements will be each panel member will give an opening statement, followed by some discussion among all of us, and then concluding with a question and answer period with the audience. So with that, I'll turn it over to Professor Loyola.
Thank you, Judd. Great to be with all of you. Thank you to the Federalists.
That we're hosting in this, I was gonna say. And thank you very much, it's been great to talk to you. I'm gonna start by just making a couple of comments that could as easily apply to almost any other topic area that's being discussed at the National Lawyers Convention, which is that almost everything that we're concerned with, everything that Americans worry about and that Americans hope to accomplish in the years and decades ahead depends in one way or another on making sure that America remains or becomes once again an attractive place to do business, to make investments, to innovate, and to create jobs. And for that, we need a competitive framework of regulation and taxation. I mean, an internationally competitive framework of regulation and taxation. And there's, you know, luckily the Europeans have been trying hard to make sure that they don't beat us to a competitive framework of regulation and taxation. But we face a very strange and counterintuitive challenge from China, where you know, we have a communist party that has figured out how to maintain control and ownership of enterprises, but actually imposes, in some cases, dramatically fewer regulatory burdens on companies, and has become, in many ways, is an easier place for capitalist corporations to do business than in the United States. And I would submit that that's evidence of a serious problem. And the problem is that in the last century or so, the United States has gotten really dug in on progressive levels of overregulation and taxation, the whole progressive scheme of government that has really, I think, neutered the genius of the original constitutional structure, which was most exemplified in this hyper competitive economy that we had in the second half of the 19th century, where that genius framework of interstate regulatory and tax competition with very little regulatory or tax activity at the national level, and just an absolute, you know, with progressives, the progressive pejorative race to the bottom is actually a race to the top in the sense of achieving what people will see as an optimal level of regulation and taxation. That genius has gotten buried under national regulation and taxation, that the whole point of which, as Richard Epstein likes to say, was to make the world safe for cartels and monopolies. And so what we've got here now, in when America looks to the future, tries to wonder how it can maintain its dominance of innovation and high technology that it's been blessed with in the last 100 years, it faces some very real challenges, and telecommunications policy highlights many of these challenges. These challenges are not unique to telecommunications policy, but telecoms policy is a good microcosm of a lot of the very serious challenges that we face in trying to come up with a competitive framework of regulation and taxation. The inability to modernize spectrum, to the allocation of spectrum, particularly where the demand for spectrum is growing the fastest, which is in mid-band, which is where we have wireless communications, shows, you know, all of the problems of vested interests that are using the regulatory regime to protect not just established players, but outmoded ways of doing business and outmoded technologies from disruptive innovations that people greatly prefer. We see that again, we see that in other problems in BEAD funding, the funding for the broadband equity access and deployment program, which the Biden administration has channeled, has used to favor wire communications and wire infrastructure, even though for that last segment of the often rural areas that they want to connect, what makes much more sense, both from the point of view of the consumer and the providers, is wireless communication. So that shows, this shows another problem that's not common to telecoms policy that we see in Technicolor with the Inflation Reduction Act subsidies for wind and solar, which is that the government subsidies not only represent a misallocation of social resources, but they cause the private sector to misallocate social resources, right? And to misallocate investments. And these distorting effects are, another example of some part of my sort of Federalist Society stump speech on federalism and federal-state relations is that federal money poisons everything that it touches. And here is an example of where that's true as well. Very briefly, I'll just skip over some of the other issues that my esteemed colleagues will touch on. But I just want to make a note about the Federal Communications Commission. I'm at Heritage Foundation, a senior fellow at Heritage Foundation, where the great Ed Meese, we have our Constitutional Law Center is named after Ed Meese. Ed Meese, you will remember, said, in his great speech against the Supreme Court's decision in Humphrey's Executor in 1935, agencies are not quasi this or quasi that, his great resounding vindication of the unitary executive. For those of you not familiar, Humphrey's Executor was the decision that said that if Congress charges an agency with exercising judicial or legislative functions, then apparently nobody needs to control it. And it could just run itself. Fantastically unconstitutional, anti-constitutional, anti-democratic decision that was sort of the logical conclusion of Woodrow Wilson's scheme of progressive government, which imported Germanic technocracy. You don't have to worry, it will rule over you, so you don't have to worry about ruling over yourselves, kind of thing. And I will just say that I hope we're now chipping away at, if I can nominate another decision after the fall of Chevron for the Supreme Court to upset a longstanding doctrine, it would be Humphrey's Executor. Agencies are not quasi this or quasi that. Any agency that exercises executive branch, executive functions should be controlled, should be within the president's control. And if people are uncomfortable with that agency exercising broad legislative or judicial powers, then Congress can curtail those powers and return this sort of thing to the free market. We've got some thorny compromises that we've had to make within the art of the possible, but hopefully the solution here is not going to be incremental changes on a model that doesn't really work. Like, you know, a lot of regulation is as if we had to operate on the basis of Windows 2000 until the end of time, instead of starting with new operating systems. And here, I think telecoms is yet another policy area where we really need just a new operating system, and hopefully that new operating system will not have to involve the FCC at all. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor. Next up is Scott.
So, I learned something recently. So I don't have a little button. Does this seem to be on? Okay. I thought I had. All right. So, I learned something recently. If a high-power electric line is blown down in a storm, the electric utility can cut the power to that line before it hits the ground, reducing the risk of injury, reducing the risk of wildfire. But it can only do that if it has sufficient wireless bandwidth to transmit the needed data. So I've spent the last 2 years or so working at NTIA, at the Department of Commerce, trying to increase access to spectrum, access to the radio frequencies used by wireless communications devices and sensors for both the private sector and government. Obtaining spectrum access is both increasingly important and increasingly difficult. To put it simply, the growth of our economy, our national security, and our public safety are all dependent on expanding spectrum access. Wireless carriers need additional spectrum access to provide broadband to the home in rural areas and elsewhere. And as AI becomes embedded in everything, our handheld devices are going to need more spectrum to handle the additional data that the wireless carriers will carry. But it isn't just the communications sector that needs more spectrum access. The transportation sector needs more spectrum because for both efficiency and supply chain integrity, it's ever more important to know the location of trucks and containers and what's in those trucks and containers and what's going on inside those trucks and containers. The manufacturing sector needs more spectrum that can be used in factories and warehouses to operate robots and that can be used for quality control in the manufacturing process. The space sector needs more spectrum to accommodate the astonishing growth in low Earth orbit satellite systems that are providing truly global connectivity. And for the burgeoning launch and space economy, at NTIA, companies came in to talk to us about getting spectrum to set up communications systems between the Earth and the Moon and around the Moon. And you might have noticed I haven't yet mentioned government use of the spectrum. Not to be overly dramatic, but the government needs spectrum to access to track enemy missiles and aircraft, manned and unmanned, and to shoot them down as needed. Commanders need to collect and to provide real-time information to warfighters on the battlefield, in the skies, and on the ocean, think South China Seas, and to get real-time information in return. Government spectrum access is also necessary to identify and prepare for life-threatening weather events, to protect police, to protect firefighters and civilians, and let's not forget about protecting aircraft that are trying to land. The demand for spectrum access only ever increases. And for our economic and for our physical well-being, we as a nation must meet that demand. But with all the demands, and with all of these demands increasing, how can you possibly do that? The answer is we need to find ways to use spectrum more effectively. So a year ago, this week, the White House issued a national spectrum strategy designed to increase spectrum access both in the short term and the long term. We at NTIA work with the NSC, OSTP, the NEC, the executive branch agencies, including importantly the Department of Defense, and the FCC in crafting that strategy, but only after we sought and received substantial private sector input. The strategy has four pillars. The first, create a spectrum pipeline by identifying for near-term study almost 2,800 megahertz of spectrum in five different bands for potential repurposing, meaning studies to see if additional spectrum access would be possible. And I don't think it'll shock anyone if I tell you our hypothesis was that yes, more spectrum access is and has to be possible. Second, to create a new long-term spectrum planning process. When we began this effort, we wanted to bring together spectrum stakeholders, both from the public and private sectors. And we found that there was literally no existing mechanism to do that. So we decided that a new cooperative spectrum planning process was required, one also between, so we could bring the private sector and the public sector together, and one which also allowed for classified discussions between industry and government. Third, we wanted to encourage the development of new technologies by creating spectrum test beds that could be used by the private sector to develop and test new technologies and spectrum sharing techniques. And to begin an 18-month effort by the led by the Department of Defense to develop advanced methods of dynamic spectrum sharing. And finally, to develop a national spectrum workforce plan to prioritize the development of and enhancements to the spectrum workforce. We had no intention when we went into this of talking about workforce issues. Did not occur to us, certainly did not occur to me. But when we sat down with folks in the private sector and we sat down with folks in the government agencies, everyone said this was an issue that needed to be addressed. So 4 months after the plan was issued, NTIA issued a detailed plan identifying all of the steps required to implement the strategy, assigned those steps to specific agencies, and set out timelines both for beginning each step and for ending each step. And we made all of that public. And why? Because we wanted there to be public accountability so that the public and the Hill could track the progress that was or was not being made to carry out the plan. The implementation plan was issued in March of this year. And as far as I can tell now from the outside, the agencies are, in fact, meeting all of their deadlines and all of their goals, which is all to the good for all of us. So I'll stop there, and I'm happy to take questions later.
Thank you. Next up is Robin.
Great. Let's see. Are we live? I think we are. Okay. Thanks so much to everyone for having me here today. Really, really appreciate the opportunity. I've spent a number of years and a lot of time at previous Federal Society conventions, particularly the dinner last night, right? Always a really great time and a lot of time attending panels, but this is my first time actually participating in one. So really appreciate you all having me here. I would say over the number of years, I first went to Capitol Hill in 2002 and have been working on telecommunications policy ever since and technology. Each election year, you obviously have a wide variety of reactions to the election results. I think it's fair to say around Federal Society this time, we can really feel the positive side of that energy. So a lot of enthusiasm and a lot of hopes kind of for what the next 4 years could bring. Change is definitely in the air. Change brings a lot of opportunity and also a lot of risk. With regard to the administration, issues that had been settled very well might not stay settled, I think is kind of the lesson that I've learned over the years of experience kind of in the different, looking at telecom policy from the different perspectives, from Senate, from House, from FCC, from White House. There's going to be a new slate of political appointees kind of across all these different agencies, a lot of shuffling on the Hill as well, kind of big game of musical chairs is about to start, kind of different chief counsels, and it kind of trickles all the way down. So you're just going to have a whole new range of people in these different jobs, and that brings to clients like a whole new audience who might be a lot more receptive to arguments you may or may not have been making last year. Or less receptive. My big example on this front is the C-band. So that is an issue that, basically was considered and was settled during my time in the White House at the last Trump administration. Kind of all the different agencies' objections and kind of concerns about different downsides to auctioning off the C-band, in particular Department of Commerce and FAA, all was kind of very carefully considered and ultimately rejected, right? People decided we could go ahead and deploy in that band. There certainly is a lot of 5G deployment within that band over in the EU, for example, other parts of the world, and airplanes were not falling out of the sky there, so ultimately that determination was made. What we saw at the very beginning of the new Biden administration is an effort to completely flip that decision. So you guys saw all of the headlines and the airplanes are gonna start falling out of the sky. And this is a really great concern to folks that have kind of no idea what the track record of that whole decision was. So understandably enough, everybody wants kind of our airplanes to be okay. I fault the folks at DOT and FAA for kind of going back for another bite at the apple? Absolutely not, right? If I had lost that argument within the last year, you absolutely are going to come back and say, all right, whole new round of people. Like, let's see if we can get anywhere with this time. So very happy to see that was ultimately resolved, but that's something kind of from the telecom space, a really good example of kind of this dynamic that we're all about to see, which is just kind of settled issues might not stay very settled. So there's a lot of different kind of implications of that across all the different topics that we're going to address today. From spectrum to BEAD funding, future of the universal service program, privacy, Section 230, right? Kind of whole new audience for different arguments on that. But I very much look forward to this discussion, and let's get into it.
And new mayor.
Thank you. Hey, everyone. It's great to be here. I'm really happy to be sharing the stage with Mario, with Scott, and with Robin. I'll be honest, as a Democrat, unlike Robin, this convention is a first for me. I'm convinced everyone here is on a short list for political appointment, which is exciting. It's a much different vibe in my usual circles right now, so this is fun. This is great. I want to rewind the clock a little bit, and I want to go back to the first Trump administration, and back to around 2017 and 2018, when wireless carriers really embarked on a mission. And that mission was to lead the world in the deployment of next-generation wireless networks. And they delivered. And they delivered in part because of decisive action under that administration to ensure that that next-generation digital economy was really developed on our shores. And that included by making more than 5,000 megahertz of new high, mid, and low-band spectrum available to support these new networks and all the expected activity that was going to come from them. What happened after that is a pretty remarkable technology story, I think. Wireless carriers in the United States ended up deploying 5G faster than any other generation of wireless technology before it. 5G accomplished in 3 years what 4G did in five, and that means it reached more than 1 billion subscribers around the world. It was available on more than 265 commercial networks. There were more than 2,000 devices, 40% of which cost less than $200. There were hundreds of fixed wireless access deployments, thousands of private enterprise deployments, and still there's a lot more 5G activity to come. On top of that, wireless carriers invested record amounts of their own capital in order to upgrade the technology base of the United States. In 2022, we saw record investment of $39 billion. If you go back to 2018, that number is more than $190 billion. Which makes the wireless industry the second largest direct investor in the American economy. Wireless carriers also improved the wireless experience for businesses and consumers since then. Network speeds are up 42% year over year. Fixed wireless is actually reaching into rural communities meaningfully for the first time. We see those networks connecting unserved Americans and bridging the digital divide. 20% of new adds to fixed wireless networks are first-timers to the broadband marketplace. That means they did not have the internet at home before them. No other technology is making that kind of progress in terms of closing the digital divide. And now that these networks are up and running, what we're seeing, if we come back to today, is that the technology world is just bursting with so much possibility right now. All the major 5G players, companies in other industries, startups whose names we haven't even heard of yet, they're all working on building some or all of the building blocks of the future. And we know what that is, right? It's artificial technologies, it's robotics, it's drones, it's smart homes, digital health, autonomous cars, and everything in between. From a policy perspective, what's interesting about all this is that all of those things, they share the very same dependencies. They have the same core dependencies in common. And by that, I mean they all need greater and more distributed computing power. They need new sensors. They need smarter virtual and voice recognition. They need software that's more intelligent and more secure at the same time. And they need better networks that can deliver more data to more places. I think that's what needs to be at the heart of technology policy and thinking for the new administration. how do we deliver those things? How do we deliver those networks that will help us lead in this sort of connected future that's coming? Now, if we take stock of where we are, I do think that we are facing some real headwinds to that vision of a connected future. For one thing, the United States has run out of licensed spectrum to support 5G networks. That's a problem because demand right now is on pace to far outpace supply. For another thing, the FCC has lost its authority to auction more spectrum, to put more spectrum into the marketplace. That's a first. On top of that, we do have continuing disputes between federal agencies about how spectrum should be used, which is sidelining the United States in international discussions about spectrum. And all of this is happening at a moment when we continue to face well-resourced and credible threats to our wireless leadership from other nations. So it's important now that we pick up the pace in terms of addressing some of these challenges. And the new administration can help do that. They can help ensure that we're not just maintaining our 5G leadership, but we're growing it, and we're growing it in these other critical technology areas as well. I think Scott did a great job introducing the National Spectrum Strategy, and I want to offer three thoughts about it for the new administration and how to think about it. The first is that speed is key now. The Trump administration can view the National Spectrum Strategy as a first step. To build from. There's momentum there. There are studies that have already started to find new commercial opportunity, for example, in the lower 3 gigahertz bands and the 7 and 8 gigahertz bands. These things get technical very quick. But there is momentum there to build from. The second thing is that the administration can look at simplifying and refocusing and reprioritizing. If you've looked at that national spectrum strategy lately, and maybe I'm the only one who has, but there's
not the only one.
Two of us. There are 36 initiatives in there. 32 of them are assigned to NTIA. A lot of those are still in their infancy. Sometimes the essence of strategy is choosing what not to do. And I think what we can do now is focus the National Spectrum Strategy on where it will make the most impact, and that is rebuilding a pipeline of commercial spectrum to support economic growth and innovation. And the third thing, and I think this is the most important, is that we've got to flip to focusing on outcomes as much as process. I think the biggest challenge for our industry with the National Spectrum Strategy has been that it hasn't been tied to sort of targets and goals. What do we want the world to look like 2 years from now? Without that, there's always a risk that the strategy becomes a matter of endless fascination for theorists, but a puzzle for practitioners who are trying to build networks or provide services. And as I think about how to do that, I think back to a question that General Petraeus actually is famously remembered for asking about another U.S. strategy, the strategy for military victory in Afghanistan in 2002 and in Iraq in 2003. And he said, "Tell me how this ends." That's where he started. He said, "Tell me how this ends." I think that's a great question to be asking about the National Spectrum Strategy. I think if you ask that question today to the Department of Defense or to the wireless industry or to the Department of Transportation or the cable industry, I think you'll get different answers. And it's important that we now tie the desires of our policy with the ways and means of how to do it, and take a page from other administrations and their spectrum planning efforts, and start to put some goals and targets around the spectrum strategy as well. That's going to be important for all of the technology growth that I was talking about. So that's where we need to go from here, and I'm looking forward to discussing that. Thank you.
Thanks, Sumer, and thanks, everyone. Let me start with opening it up to the panel and giving you all a chance to respond to some of the things you heard, I guess, going back in order to see if you had any reactions, responses, rebuttals.
Question for you, what are the different models for reallocating spectrum, for opening up spectrum?
Mike.
Oh, sorry.
So what are our different options for reallocating spectrum and opening them back up again? And which of them involve giving the FCC more power, and which of them involve giving the FCC less power?
I'm happy to jump into that. So in terms of spectrum allocation models, right, there's three that I'll throw out there. And you know, there's always more, but three probably capture most of what you'll see. The first, I think, I'll start with sort of this exclusive use licensing model, and I think that this has proven to be the most successful model for allocating spectrum throughout our history. And under exclusive use modeling, basically what you get is that someone has the sole right to transmit on a specific set of frequencies in a specific set, in a specific geographic area. And so wireless carriers, government agencies, utilities, TV and radio broadcasters, they all like this kind of spectrum because it gives you reliability, predictability, and certainty of access. And if you're going to put out a lot of money to build a large communications network, you want those things. You want to have that type of certainty around your ability to access the spectrum that you're building around. The FCC traditionally allocates this through auctions. And auctions have been a huge success story for the United States ever since we started using them back in the 1990s. To date, we've held more than 100 auctions. We've auctioned more than 94,000 licenses. We've raised more than $200 billion for the U.S. Treasury, and we've unlocked more than $1 trillion for the U.S. Economy in the benefit of American people. And perhaps not surprisingly, that model has been copied by almost every regulator around the world. I start here because this is where I think we need to focus most of our attention. The FCC has lost that ability to auction spectrum. I think we need to restore that. It is much, much harder, as Scott noted, to find opportunities for new exclusive use spectrum, but it is so foundational to the networks that we rely on for so many parts of our economies. And so this is where we need the most attention. After that, another allocation model is unlicensed spectrum. So this is where you don't need contract or permission to use spectrum. Wi-Fi is probably the most common example of this type of model. It's very important to the U.S. economy as well. The thing I want to leave you with on unlicensed spectrum is that the United States leads the world in availability of unlicensed spectrum, and part of that is because of a decision taken under the Trump administration to free up over 1,200 megahertz of spectrum, a decision that's been supported and advanced by the Biden administration as well for this particular use. We're leading the world on that metric. We're trailing the world when it comes to licensed spectrum. And then the third is sort of an in-between, is shared models of spectrum access. And this is an opportunity that government agencies will look at when clearing spectrum is not an option in order to allow new entrants to get into it, and so they might find an opportunity for them to share. Obviously, sharing comes with a cost for all of the parties that have to use that spectrum. It sub-optimizes the spectrum for particular uses, but it's another model that's available.
One other thing I'd say about the auction model, it generates an enormous amount of revenue, and with that revenue, you can compensate government agencies or private parties which need to vacate the spectrum. So while the Department of Defense may not want to move this particular system, with the amount of money generated by the auctions, it can be paid and compensated for moving its systems and improving its systems and create an incentive to create more spectrum availability for the private sector. And without auction authority, actually none of that is possible. And that works with the private sector as well. It's C-band, it was used by the private sector by satellite companies. They were compensated for moving off of the spectrum which was better allocated for terrestrial wireless networks. One other thing about the spectrum strategy, though, is that we actually did have anticipated outcomes built in, right? And if you get into the details of the studies that are outlined, it actually becomes more obvious. So if you look at the lower 3 gigahertz band, we're talking about wireless broadband. You're talking about 7.8. You're talking the 7.8 gigahertz bands. It's focused on wireless broadbands, and the first thing to be studied is exclusive high-powered use. May not come out that way, but that's what's being studied. So there is actually a goal there. At 5 gigahertz, we're looking at spectrum for unmanned aerial systems, drones. We need more spectrum for that. At 18 gigahertz, we're looking at satellite systems. And if you go into the studies, actually, you will see goals there. The one thing it won't tell you is what the outcome of the study will be, because after all, they are, I don't know, studies. And it's amazing how complicated and difficult the technical part of this stuff is, something I will not understand. But the last thing you want to do, it seems to me, and I want more private sector spectrum, is for a military commander to find out he can't communicate with a jet that's over the South Pacific. You don't want to screw that up. And so that's why, in my personal view, having these studies are critical to getting the right result. You can have goals, you can have plans, but you need to actually do the work. And by the way, in terms of the new administration coming in, this is profoundly nonpartisan. There are real divides here, right? You go talk to the Senate Armed Services Committee, you go talk to the Senate Commerce Committee, you get two very different views, but it's not partisan based.
Yeah, so I would agree with a lot of what my colleagues have said up here. Would note the last time we actually kind of were able to free up some spectrum to be auctioned is while I was at the White House. So that was done under the AMBIT process, under which we freed up 3.45 pretty much for exclusive use. A little bit of kind of caveats and wiggle room there. I think technically you could have called AMBIT spectrum sharing, right? Because we were able to kind of carve out specific geolocations around some specific systems at some specific bases. But for the most part, we were able to clear that spectrum in the entire continental United States. What I would say about this whole process and the auction authority discussion, right now, you know, my colleagues have done a lot of really great work, I think, with the National Spectrum Strategy and kind of moving things forward on some studies. But right now, I mean, the reality is spectrum pipeline is dry. There's just nothing in there to even think about auctioning. We're nowhere near close to agreement on any band to kind of even be in that pipeline. I use, for folks that aren't kind of familiar with the spectrum conversation, which a lot of telecom people even are not, right? If you're more focused in the media or the wireline side, spectrum's a little bit opaque, right? But it's pretty simple. I use kind of the Girl Scout cookie analogy. That's like some experience that I had in my past. The FCC chairman has a ton of authority in a lot of different areas in telecom. But with regard to spectrum, basically, their role here in the Girl Scout cookie analogy, they're the salesman, right? They got to have some cookies to sell. So that's what they do. They run the auctions. The FCC does an amazing, amazing job with a model that's copied all throughout the world. But if they don't have any cookies to sell, they can't kind of go door to door and be selling the cookies, right? So where do the cookies get made? That's in the administration. And that's just a much, much, much harder process. That generally is a consensus type of process. So my hat is completely off to Scott with what he was able to accomplish as the National Spectrum Strategy. While I was in the White House, I shepherded, you know, potentially kind of a predecessor effort to that, or a complementary effort to that, let's call it. It was the National Strategy to Secure 5G. We got that out the door, and also right on the eve of kind of the change of administrations, the implementation strategy for that. And just having been through that process and shepherding that process from kind of White House perspective, it's consensus process. You've got like 30 different agencies involved. Like every agency that potentially has any sort of dog in the fight, even if it's like a chihuahua, has to be at the table and they have to sign off like ultimately on what this big document is going to say. So I would argue it's really, really difficult for any of us to kind of move policy very far with one of those big kind of strategy documents. There is a tendency toward like kind of lowest common denominator that you can get everybody to agree on like kind of specific language for this really, really long thing. I mean, people can just be nitpicking at like words and sentences. So it takes a long time. Hats off for what you were able to accomplish there. On National Spectrum Strategy, what I would say is, unfortunately, and I think some of us might agree with this a little bit, the implementation has totally stalled out, right? It basically launched this whole PATHS process by which you get kind of this collaboration and the industry coming in with the different agencies to try to hammer out some sort of compromise on the lower three. Now, I think everybody kind of new going into that process. Lower three is like really, really, really difficult band to work out. There are some serious systems in there that the military is running. They are kind of operational throughout the United States, kind of always on type of systems. So it's a much, much harder task, much more difficult Rubik's Cube to solve than what we did on 3.45. It's like the band right below that. So we all knew that was going to be really difficult, and it continues to be, right? But what you have is basically a whole bunch of meetings, and everybody kind of has an equal place at the table. And what they've done is kind of, I feel like, argued to a draw, right? We're not to any sort of resolution with it yet. The Embers report was put out. That was almost a year ago that was sent over to the relevant committees on Capitol Hill with like a big long assessment, you know. A lot of it's classified. My gathering of what Embers report said is basically we really can't do much here, and it's just all gonna be sharing. And maybe that is the ultimate answer, but you know, kind of going back to the PAS group, they haven't been able to kind of reach consensus and actually put something out the door that even can be implemented there. So that's kind of the closest process I would kind of recognize right now on the different bands of spectrum to actually producing some cookies that then we can kind of get the auction authority going and be able to sell some cookies. So that would be great, and I think that's the first order of business for the new administration. Different folks that are kind of come in at these jobs across Department of Commerce and in the White House and at NSC is to break the logjam on PAS and finally bring the lower three to a resolution. Next priority after that is what Umair and Scott were both talking about. So we need to look at 7 and 8. A lot of consensus already throughout the world that is kind of the prime location for 6G implementations. And that's what we need to be thinking about right now. We actually, believe it or not, are already behind on spectrum for 6G. EU and China are making serious efforts right at this point to be seriously studying and starting to allocate bands for 6G. And all of the standard setting bodies are already looking at standards, right? We're kind of moving along toward the next generation of wireless, and we already need to be thinking about where the spectrum's gonna be for that. Let's see, a couple other things. Yeah. I would agree, exclusive use so far, a really successful model, but sometimes sharing is the only thing you're gonna be able to get. I think like realistically, a lot of us think lower three is kind of one of those cases. So I think it is really important to kind of continue the process of what Scott was talking about, of getting much, much better, much more precise dynamic spectrum sharing technologies to be developed, right? Because if sharing is gonna be a solution in one of these bands, we wanna be able to squeeze as much juice out of that band and get everybody to be able to use it as much as possible. Kind of a primitive implementation of that, of course, was CBRS at 3.5. There's technology in there right now kind of managing that. I think it's a good question. Like, can we do better than that technology and CBRS right now? I think there's a lot of companies out there doing really dynamic things in this space that should be looked at for the technology solution where sharing is kind of the solution to the band.
Can I jump in? So I'm not giving up on the lower three. The Department of this is a band that is heavily used, as Robin says, by the Department of Defense. It's also a band that is of great interest to the private sector. The Department of Defense did its own study under what it's called the PATHS process. I don't even remember what PATHS stands for anymore, but whatever. And the study, in my view, was insufficient. It was so insufficient that when we drafted the National Spectrum Strategy, we said, you know what? We're gonna look at this again, and we're gonna look at a much broader range of questions here. So for example, the Department of Defense in its study did not even consider the possibility of relocating any of its systems. Well, actually, that was the first thing they should have looked at, but they didn't even study it. And so that's why we're taking a look at it in the National Spectrum Strategy. And that has not petered out in any way. In fact, the study has not yet begun. The study has been outlined. We're just waiting for DOD to get some money so it could actually carry out the study in conjunction with NTIA. So we're not giving up on lower three. My guess is, if I had to, there is gonna be spectrum available, and not just on a CBRS-like basis at lower three. Don't know this, did I mention? We're doing studies, and that's the way to go with this. But what the Trump administration can do and should do is hold everybody to those deadlines. We knew an election was coming up, right? When we put the implementation plan in place, the language is actually precise. It says who's going to run each of the parts of the study, which agencies are going to be in charge of what, and what by what dates they need to do stuff. If the agencies are held to that, you will have spectrum to auction, assuming Congress gives us auction authority back, in time for the wireless carriers to do what they need to do for 5G and 6G. We timed it all out. We spoke to the private sector. We knew by when they said they wanted the spectrum available for auction. We can meet those deadlines. We can meet their needs, provided that the dates in that implementation plan are adhered to, and they should be.
Maybe I can just pull on one thread that Robin was talking about as well, which is sharing and sort of what is the role of it, what's the future of it. Look, I think the United States has to get better at sharing. I think it will get better at sharing. But I think that it's got to be a matter of incentives. And I think there's a couple of things that we've got to think about is happening around that discussion of sharing, which is that it is sometimes being used to shift the center of gravity of spectrum policymaking away from expert agencies like FCC and NTIA and more to the DoD. Through processes like PATS or other things. And that's something that I think we really have to pay attention to. When the DoD talks about sharing today, actually, let me take a step back. There's spectrum sharing that Robin was talking about, like the AMBIT program, which I think was a success and the type of sharing that's available today and that we should explore. When the DoD talks about spectrum sharing today, what they seem to be talking about is you take a band like the lower 3 gigahertz band, and the DoD won't change anything about how they're using that band. They won't lift a finger, they won't change anything. And if the wireless industry can figure out how to weave in between those existing uses, and if they can do that using limited information, because there's some classified uses in there that you'll never know about, and if they can do it using the absolute worst cases assumptions about interference, if you can take all that and show that, yeah, you can weave in, then the DoD says, sure, we'll let you in. But if we need it again in the future, we'll kick you right back out. You can't deploy.
It's so true, Umair. Like, the founding assumption of AMBIT was we're going to try to clear as much as we can first and then work around what we can't, right? And that is the foundational assumption that's kind of missing in some of the studies.
Is there a role for Congress in this? What are the prospects of a spectrum bill, and what would that even look like?
Okay, so like I said, I've worked on this from kind of quadfecta of different spots in town where you can take a look at this and try to get something to happen. It's really, really difficult to legislate in this. I think Umair would agree. It's not a partisan issue at all. Two of us are on total agreement with what needs to be done here. The problem is Republicans and Democrats on the Armed Services Committees are listening to DoD and saying, yeah, we can't do anything here. So that's what we've seen, and that kind of explains the entire impasse that has been going on for the last year and change on auction authority. We haven't been able to get it extended, even like kind of in a blanket mode of not identifying any bands. We're not saying we're auctioning anything. We're just saying if the government could come up with something for them to auction, we're gonna just extend the authority for a short period of time. Can't even get those committees to agree on that. So the problem is, on the Hill, it plays to a draw. The problem is, in the administration, it also tends to play to a draw, right? Because you're running these interagency processes, and the DoD is a really big foot kind of in that discussion, kind of no matter who else you have at the table. What happened in AMBIT, frankly, that broke kind of the system here is that President Trump himself told the DoD that they had to work with us and kind of cough up the data as to the systems that were in that band and try to work something out with us. And again, that kind of came down to what Scott was saying of actually setting some targets and some goals. So when we went into that discussion and when we had that principal level meeting, there was a target put on that we were looking to meet, and we were able to meet it. But, I mean, really, who else but the president is going to be able to tell DoD, you got to actually work with these guys on this? And so I do have kind of hope for this second term that someone might be able to make that happen again.
I share the hope. I think that we've got, it seems like the opportunity to pass spectrum legislation is higher than it's been in a very long time right now. And we've got opportunities like reconciliation and other opportunities in which to actually explore that and move that forward. Senators Cruz and Thune have a Spectrum Pipeline Act that I think will probably be the starting point of a conversation. What Robin was saying, that this is bipartisan, I think is absolutely true. And the reality is that we know how to do this. Congress has enacted multi-year extensions of the FCC's auction authority many, many times before. And they've always done it with a pipeline of new spectrum for the FCC to auction. That's the model that's in the Cruz and Thune bill. That's the model that we need to follow now. There's certainly gonna be some headwinds to overcome, but I'm optimistic.
And I would just jump in and say that hopefully all of, you know, the next congressional authorization here will observe these basic principles of, you know, being technology neutral, being as pro-innovation as possible, not favoring established players, because DoD is not the only vested interest in the current system that will block innovation. And we see in other policy areas, autonomous vehicles, energy that recipients of current benefits, there's nothing that people defend as vigorously as an unfair advantage that the government has given them over others. And so I hope that we will be able to maintain this, you know, a framework that favors disruptive innovation as much as possible, right? This is something where I think we can be very hopeful that Elon Musk will have a real impact. Elon Musk is undertaking a big project to advance government efficiency. He faces a tall learning curve in many areas because the problem is much worse than he realizes. But one area where he's not gonna necessarily face that tall of a learning curve is spectrum, because Starlink is a very disruptive innovation which has already been on the receiving end of political, some would say political action to head it off at the pass. And hopefully Congress will be able to take the attitude that it had in the 1990s at the dawn of the internet, when people like Ira Magaziner, Clinton's advisor, took a sort of super pro-innovation approach to the development of the internet, and take a similar approach to spectrum.
Let me move us away from spectrum for a minute and ask
audience
about
questions?
Yes, we'll have a minute for audience questions. Sure. Let me just ask one quick question then about the Universal Service Fund. And there was a Fifth Circuit decision earlier this year holding that system unconstitutional as a unlawful, unconstitutional delegation of taxing authority. What's happening on the legal front there? I know that opened up a circuit split, and what's next for funding projects in that space?
So I think this is a problem absolutely needs to be and will be addressed by the Hill. Unclear whether Supreme Court's gonna grant cert. Everybody's kind of waiting for that decision to kind of see what happens next. But we are in a situation here, programs have been declared unconstitutional. There is like devastating impact were you to just take down the entire Universal Service Fund in one day. So what that does, there's like a ton of funding for rural broadband networks that are otherwise like not really economic to build, for low income service, broadband service, mobile service, equipment for low income consumers, and then also service to schools and libraries. And a lot of this is not really like aligned with economic incentives for people to be providing these services. So if you cut it off one day, a lot of these rural carriers just immediately go out of business. Like that is what a crisis this is. So everybody's looking at kind of ways to solve it. It has to be solved by Congress. It could be solved with a really, really simple piece of legislation, like kind of a one sentence thing saying, no, this is okay. And you know, basically the problem with it is the funding mechanism of how the FCC basically delegated authority to the Universal Service, USAC, basically to administer the fund. So that's kind of the legal problem with the authority here. But what I would say is, this absolutely opens up the conversation. There's nothing that Hill likes to do as much as like kind of kick things like this around. So I don't think they're probably going to do a one-sentence fix unless just suddenly some decision comes down where we reach that crisis point where people are literally about to go out of business the next day. They're going to be taking a look at this. This is an opportunity to totally re-envision how USF works, how it's funded, who is paying into this fund. The senior Republican over the FCC right now, Commissioner Carr, who could potentially be the next FCC chairman, has stated a lot of interest before in kind of getting big tech to actually kick into the Universal Service Fund. It's something that, like, the funding has been slowly dwindling over the years because it is paid as like a tax, basically by a taxpayer, only on wireline lines. So think about how many people are cutting the cord and don't have those anymore. So those consumers are not paying this tax. Only like this really small, like dwindling percentage of people are paying this tax.
It's
not charged on cable, it's not charged on wireless, right? So the pot is getting a lot smaller. So like, let's look for ways to kind of expand the pot. And that's one kind of potential thing. It's like, who's getting the benefit of all of these broadband networks is big tech, right? Their content is the ones that's like carried over all these networks all the time, and they don't really kick in anything for funding all of these really expensive networks that need to be built out to people. So that's kind of one idea. Like, legally, how do you actually make that happen, I think, is a lot bigger of a question. But this is going to continue to play out over the next 6 months, but the Hill is going to be all over it. I expect hearings on both House and Senate side in the first quarter. So through those hearings, we're going to get to hear aired out, like, kind of everybody's ideas about how you would tweak this, because it really opens the door to kind of anything.
And can I just jump into it and say that this is one area where government efficiency, I mean, one important principle of government efficiency is how much is every dollar of benefit to the beneficiary actually costing society? I don't think there's any pro. I love the idea behind the Americans with Disabilities Act, but I think that every dollar of benefit to the disabled might be costing people $300,000 or something like that. And we have something similar with the Universal Service Fund. It's possible that every providing service to every beneficiary costs $5,000 or $10,000 a year, and it's quite obvious that the private sector could do that much more cheaply. So hopefully we'll be able to have this, some kind of rational cost-benefit analysis in Congress, which is, not, maybe they need remedial education on cost-benefit analysis. But.
All right, we've got about 20 minutes remaining for audience questions, so whoever would like to ask a question for the panel.
I'm a software guy. I worked at Microsoft in the 20th century. So a comment, what I heard is, the DoD, which are still flying B-52s and running Windows 2000 probably on most of their battleships, should probably be forced to abandon all that low bandwidth frequency, which would be more used for better things. That's a comment. My question is, during the whole 5G build out and all the standards work, you know, the Chinese were very involved, Huawei, et cetera, and there was a big concern about their influence on those standards and also the national security implications of their componentry. So I'm wondering, in the 6G, this is off topic from what you guys have been talking about, but in the 6G world, how is that sort of standards effort playing out?
So that was something definitely directly addressed in the national strategy to secure 5G, big mouthful there. Is basically ensuring more U.S. participation in those standard-setting bodies. I think there's a big recognition, again, this is not at all a partisan issue, everybody is in total agreement about kind of the process fouls that are going on within those standard-setting bodies and like kind of the tendency of the Chinese to kind of pack these committees and really kind of influence how things are going. So it's definitely something that folks are focused on from the administration level and attempting to address. For us as Americans, it's a really fine line between making sure that our companies are able to participate in those and doing some sort of top-down government direction of what America should be doing in those, right? So we don't act like China. We're not trying to out-China China, but it's a huge concern. And something that folks continue to try to address, and it absolutely will be on the table for the next administration to kind of see what you can do here. It's like, you know, all the way down to the level. One of the kind of sub issues when I was working on this is that, you know, some of our folks from companies like Microsoft being disqualified because of kind of having anything to do with any sort of project that was anywhere in China, and then like they're just suddenly off the table to be. And so we don't want that effect. We want absolutely full, robust US company participation in these things, and we want to support that however we can. But it's a little bit of a balance ideologically. How can the government do that without overstepping into directing that?
Yeah, completely agree. I think the first thing I would say is that this problem of the Chinese government exerting influence in standards bodies is not unique to 5G or 6G. And so you see it at the International Telecommunication Union, you see it in working bodies that develop Wi-Fi standards. This is a problem that's broader than any singular technology. The second thing that I would say is that for the United States, I think we've got to do a little bit of looking into sort of what are the voluntary consensus-based standards organizations where we get the most value, where we really need to focus, right? There are probably bodies where the Chinese government is exerting influence and all we're doing there is playing defense. There are bodies where we are actually pushing forward the standards that are going to matter for the United States and prioritizing sort of how do we address this problem in that way as well. I think what Robin said about private sector leadership in these standards efforts is absolutely critical. The government is going to need help in order to do that. But ultimately, I think the best answer to Huawei and that challenge is exactly what Robin said. The United States needs to lead. We need to lead domestically. We need to have positions that we can take forward internationally as well.
And can I just add one more thing, too? I'm very pro-innovation, but the B-52 will never be old.
Thank you. Is this on? G'day, my name's Mitch. I'm from Australia. Just wanted to make two comments. One wearing a former hat of mine, which was our ambassador to the United Nations, and that is the importance of coordinating with like-minded countries to make sure that we get elected to positions such as the Secretary General of the ITU, people who take a positive and independent approach. Very fortunate now that we have an American national as Secretary General of the ITU. There was a Chinese national for 10 years beforehand. So we have to be very vigilant and we have to look ahead in these international standard setting bodies to make sure that we have people from countries that are like-minded in a strong campaigning position to get elected. That's the first comment I want to make, because it's something historically that like-minded countries have not done well. And Dorian's election, though, was an exception, and that was great. The other is wearing...
The NTIA, I need to say, are very proud of Dorian, who's a former NTIA staffer.
Here.
And it was all of government effort to help her get elected to run the ITU. A big, big deal.
That's right. All of government effort with international partners as well. The other comment or observation I want to make, wearing another former hat of mine, which was Australia's Minister for Telecommunications and Cyber Safety, is you mentioned American leadership with... issues such as Huawei and security and their participation. Wholeheartedly agree that we need strong American leadership, but I just want to say on the issue of banning Huawei from telecommunications networks, it was Australia that provided the leadership, and I was the minister who took the decision before any other country in the world that it wasn't going to happen. And so, yes, we want US leadership. Yes, we want US leadership, but also it's important for other countries to recognise that they can provide leadership as well, because sometimes there can be debates going on in countries such as the US, and we can help make it easier for countries such as the US to make the right decision, and also make it easier for countries such as the UK to reverse the decision that they had made.
And can I just add... Just jump in here, because I think this is really important, a really important dimension of this great 21st century competition and confrontation between China and the United States, the Chinese model and the American model, which is that the Chinese have developed, you know,
disruptive innovation and communist disruptive innovation of communism, which is this state ownership of over a very hyper-competitive, innovative private economy, and big corporations that show up with you know, with spy services and with armies to the competition, and they're exploiting the seam between the public and private sector in free societies. And this is, you know, the telecoms and internet is rife with these problems. For example, the U.S. has long practiced espionage, but it doesn't practice espionage for the benefit of private companies. And the Chinese see that, and they're like, that's a stupid rule. That's your rule. That's not our rule. We are totally practicing espionage for the benefit of our companies. And so, you know, this is an area where, you know, I know that this is an area where the Chinese are really, you know, the Defense Department in the first Trump administration, the Defense Department released a national defense strategy that had, you know, revisionist, there was a chapter on revisionist powers that treated Russia and China as kind of a category. Russia and China are not members of a category, of a relevant category, other than that they challenged the United States. Russia has like minor disputes, not minor disputes, but it has, you know, it feels like it got the short end of the stick at the fall of the Soviet Union, 1991. It wants to revise all that. It's committing a war of aggression. That's true. But China is challenging basic tenets of the international system as understood by democracies. And this is an area where it's doing that. And one part of the response is going to have to be much greater cooperation between the public and private spheres in our democracies to fend that off. And the ability of the private sector to carry on some of these defense functions that we normally associate with monopolies of the sovereign state, especially, for example, in the cloud, right? And so that's something where we need to be very forward-looking because the Chinese are turning the distinction, the division between public and private spheres into a real weakness for us, and it shouldn't be.
It's interesting. These things are all so connected, and you know, it seems like today, increasingly, there's this view in the United States, and you see it most evidently in the spectrum debates, but it's broader than that. There's this view that national power for the United States is going to come from our military continuing to hold these spectrum assets, right? And that's why you get this view that any amount made available for the commercial sector will harm the United States. Meanwhile, if you look at how China is thinking about these things, how the Chinese government is thinking about these things, they view it as their national power is coming from the success of their commercial technologies and the proliferation of those technologies around the world. I think if we really want to compete with that, we've got to build a broader base of prosperity in the United States as well.
Any other questions?
Yeah. I can just speak up pretty loud. Oh, okay, thank you. Getting back to Professor Loyal, you mentioned the Americans with Disabilities Act, and I'm curious what the USAC, what impact the USAC decision would have on the Telecommunications Relay Service Fund.
Just like everything else in there, blown up.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
I mean, this is really cataclysmic. Right, were the Fifth Circuit decision to hold, it just takes down everything immediately.
And is there a reason that those functions couldn't be brought back into the FCC? Would that fix it?
You know, FCC would have to look and kind of go over, and they do this stuff all the time, right? Like, let's review everything in the Communications Act and come up with some other potential source of statutory authority to be able to continue that service. I haven't looked at that myself. I don't know what that would be. I'm sure they could come up with some sort of answer, like maybe it works under here. But ultimately, the USF bigger question is going to have to be solved kind of for the future of all these different programs.
Yeah, I think that, you know, it depends on what happens, right? There's ultimately part of it comes down to the non-delegation doctrine, right? And there's two questions related to that. Was the delegation from Congress to the FCC, was that an appropriate delegation? And then was the delegation from the FCC to the USAC also appropriate? And so the Fifth Circuit decision was a little bit, ambiguous with that. It didn't come out and straightforwardly say that either of those was unconstitutional, but it said the whole scheme together was. And so I think as we piece that apart and understand that a little better, questions like that will become a little more clear.
Beyond the legal issue, I think there's been consensus in town for a long time that the USF system as currently constituted is broken and has needed to be revised. And we couldn't come to consensus how to do it, so it just chugged along. If nothing else, even if it doesn't survive, I think the Fifth Circuit decision is basically handing it back to Congress and saying, you know what, now really is time to come up with a better system. Now is time to fix it. And I think, again, there's broad consensus that it needs to be fixed. And the devil is, of course, always in the details, but I think Congress will take it and will come up with some way of redoing the way USF is done.
I mean, yes, this would definitely be just kind of the courts punting back and saying, go fish, right, essentially, to Congress. As I said, it's always on the table. This can be fixed with one sentence. And so that ultimately, right, if it gets blown up, is the question for Congress. Do we just want to, like, do one sentence and kind of maintain status quo and kick this can down the road? Which, you know, to be honest, we've seen Congress do a lot of on a whole lot of varying issues. So that option is kind of there. But I don't think that'll happen without at least opening up the discussion.
But there is a, there is, we do see, it is an important milestone in what we see as a progression, especially with this, maybe what's going to go down is probably one of the key defining features of this period in the Roberts Court, which is that the courts and now the federal judiciary behind the Supreme Court, following the footsteps of the Supreme Court, is becoming increasingly focused on the separation of powers as a principle that needs to be applied in all cases. And that is a principle that cannot be escaped. And because it needs to be applied in all cases, it's becoming a rule of decision, not just in stuff like West Virginia and Chevron, the Loper-Bright decision, but all across the board. And you know, this is really, really profound historical development, because as I mentioned at the outset, you know, one way to think about the birth of the progressive state is that, you know, Woodrow Wilson did his PhD at Johns Hopkins, which at the time was like a hotbed of Germanophile political philosophy in the United States. And of course, the Germans believed in letting us, let us rule over you so that you, to save you the trouble of having to rule over yourselves. And that's how we got agencies that do legislation and judging, as well as law enforcement, grafted onto a constitutional scheme that is totally incompatible with that idea, which is the constitutional scheme of separated powers. And so I think that you see between this and Jarchese, I think that you're going to see when they punt the ball back to Congress, Congress is going to have to take cognizance of the fact that this is not just an isolated ruling, but it's a steady erosion of the ability to set up agencies that perform these multiple functions, and thank God.
Time for one or two more questions.
I was just wondering if you could speak just a little bit more about cybersecurity. I'll throw it to anybody on the panel. Just what are some of the bigger issues that you're seeing in this realm? I mean, we see we see these things on the front page of the paper every day. So I'm just curious as to kind of what big issues you're tracking.
Well, I could just jump in on that and say that the cybersecurity is the prime example of the problem I mentioned a moment ago, of the Chinese, for example, exploiting the seam between public and private sectors. And here, the way to think about it is that the US government cannot defend private networks from a cyber attack because the Fourth Amendment prohibits their presence on the private network, right? So the government cannot be, in order for the government to defend private networks from a cyber attack, it has to be essentially surveilling the private network. And the solution for that is for greater cooperation between NSA, which does have those capabilities, and the AWSs and Azures and the cloud service providers that can provide that. I mean, one thing to think about is that the cloud is much, I analogize this to why in feudal times did castles get built that the villagers could retreat to when, that the peasants could retreat to when the region was under attack. because they couldn't defend themselves in their little abodes. And part of the problem that we have with cybersecurity is everybody is trying to defend themselves in their little abode with McAfee or whatever, and that's, People's Liberation Army section, whatever it is, 5210, will get inside your little abode in a second. And so it's the cloud service providers that have the ability to really have sophisticated AI to be able to respect your, be able to respect your privacy and detect intrusions in these algorithms. And then the other thing I would say is that we need greater use of all source intelligence, which is, you've got the NSA to detect an intrusion on cyber, but you've got the NSA using signals intelligence to do espionage within the Chinese regime, and we have to have a greater willingness to, if we're not conducting espionage for the commercial benefit of companies, we have to have a greater willingness to use all source intelligence and our national defense capabilities to protect our private networks.
All right, one more question.
One last question.
So I took a Starlink to 74 degrees north in Canada July last year, got 140 meg down, 40 meg up. That's pretty amazing. When I read about these rural broadband things here, it seems like it'd be just cheaper to let them buy Starlinks. I'm an investor in a rocket launch company in Seattle, not that we need another one, but we have another one. Their rockets will fly every day. In a future where it's $30 a month for all you can eat bandwidth from space, how does that change some of this stuff?
Well, I would say the immediate kind of spot where you're gonna see this come into play is BEAD. So that's the broadband equity access. Anyway.
And deployment.
Yeah, there we go. So that was under the IIJA, $45 billion of funding for basically the NTIA. Yeah, NTIA is supposed to put out to all the states is the model. So that's different than like a way a lot of the federal grant programs run. USF kind of directly funds things to carriers to deploy directly. This was all being filtered through the states, but the states have to submit a plan to NTIA, and then they gotta get that plan approved. What I would say, this is a big, big area in which like current administration really fumbled the ball because they basically got no money out the door. So it kind of just going back and forth with the states and like wrangling about these plans. So it actually became a campaign issue in the last 6 months of like, oh, these guys got $45 billion and like zero Americans have been connected. We're at a space now, right, where they are actually have approved like a few of these state plans, gonna try to get a little bit of money out the door, but there's huge fiber bias built into the rules. And it goes back to exactly what I was talking about at the top of this whole thing. This is a prime issue, like C-band with the last administration, where there's a huge open door right now for something that was settled to be completely unsettled. I think it's really safe to say kind of whoever gets put into NTIA is immediately gonna try to rewrite as many of those rules as possible to set more technology neutral standards. And that would open the door for more satellite, more fixed wireless to be seen. There's other kind of like requirements that could potentially be rolled back to be able to get all this stuff deployed a lot faster. But I think that's just kind of a huge opportunity for the new administration.
I think for the wireless industry, BEAD will be most effective if it is laser focused on that single mission. How do we get robust broadband to unserved and underserved areas? And I think from where we sit, we'd like to have wireless applicants and satellite applicants and fiber applicants all competing on a level playing field for that. I think satellite's certainly a part of that story. I think wireless is an important part of that story as well. As I mentioned at the start, fixed wireless access networks are proving to be a huge part of a new opportunity to get broadband into some of these areas as well.
But can I just say, I mean, if there's one progressive innovation that's worse than independent agencies deciding what's in the public interest and convenience so that the public doesn't have to, it is the federal agencies approving state plans in order to draw down federal money, which just results in federal agencies deputizing state agencies into the implementation of federal programs that they don't even want to be implementing. And so hopefully Congress will be moving forward, will be able to keep both of these things in mind let the public decide what's in the public interest and necessity, or public convenience and necessity, and keep federal and state regulatory and fiscal operations separate.
I was not doing BEAD and NTIA. What I would say, though, is the states definitely want to be implementing these programs, and I think at the end of the day, most of the key decisions will actually be made by the states. Even under the current regime of rules and whatnot, an enormous amount of authority to make the final decisions rests with the states, whether it be fixed wireless, fiber, or satellite. It was always the plan to have all these kinds of networks provide these rural services. And I think the states will end up being the critical decision makers in this before it's all over.
But can I just
satellite is $30 a month, all you can eat down bandwidth, better than wireless in many cases, let's say 8 years from now, then that changes.
So I'm not going to address that because I do work for Starlink. So I'm just going to punt on that one, but thank you for the question.
But just to respond real quick to what he said, you know, this is an area where the states would like to be doing a lot of this policy themselves, but when the federal government has a fiber bias in the program the way that it has in BEAD, now the states have to be, you know, implementing that bias, and which is something that they don't want to do, but they've created perverse incentives that make them do things that are contrary to the policy preferences of their constituents.
I would just say you don't know what the states want to do yet, right? I mean, you say, well, states don't want, who knows, right? We haven't seen all of the state plans. A lot of the states do want to do fiber, it seems. So, and I think that the great thing about the program is that it gives so much authority to the states to craft what works for their territories. Now, I think that works.
I don't think the federal government should be giving authority to the states.
All right, please join me in thanking our distinguished panel and it was a very informative discussion. Two quick announcements. First, there's a book signing for The Mies Revolution, The Making of a Constitutional Moment by Professor Stephen Calabrese and Gary Lawson. That's happening in the concourse level right after this program, so please feel free to go take a look at that. And second, we encourage you to join, to visit the Remnant Trust Rare Documents exhibit. That's in the Cardoza Room on the terrace level and is going to be open throughout the convention, so please stop by and see what they've brought this year. We're now headed to a networking break back in the schedule, and the next programming will begin at 3. With that, thanks. We're adjourned.